You've seen on the television back in the 1970s and the 80s. She was a local Kildare resident for many years. And her brother-in-law was Sir Isaac Isis, or her first brother-in-law was Sir Isaac Isis. And it's a great little yarn, if I say so myself.
It came about, my interest in this came about when I was a lawyer working in the Springvale Legal Service, and that's the main employer, that's at Springvale, and where we used to give legal aid to people, and very nice judges in the Supreme Court who would have these people who were litigating themselves without lawyers, without barristers, and had been doing it for years. The judges would say to them, "Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so, I think what you need to do now is go out and see that nice signage with the figure up and he'll help you." And the news when they came in with a suitcase stacked full of papers, and this has been a passion for many years, this probably had a lot of problems with it. But I would go through these suitcases and I'd speak to people, and usually they were hopelessly out of time and there were all sorts of cost problems and legal problems. But you always could see that there was an issue there. There was an issue there, and they probably had had rough justice, but the system had moved on and they hadn't been able to deal with it. So I said when I thought, well, when I get a bit of time, I'll go back and look at a few of these people, because there are not many of them. In fact, over 35 years in Victoria, there have been 15. And so the courts are pretty tolerant about people who they say are abusing the system. But one of them is Elsa Davis. Now, I was going to put it on the big screen, but there will be a few pictures which you may have to get a sense of it here from here. Now, if I don't know how to do this. Oops, what's happening now? Okay, well, just very quickly, gestational litigants, it's a bit of a legal term. Anyone can go to court. In fact, I argue that the barons, their running men, the King John, they were the first litigants in person. They sort of got the kick, the King men, that we're going to do it ourselves. We don't need people with King John. And they got us on the Magna Carta. So, I mean, the courts are not there for barristers and solicitors. The courts were there to resolve disputes between citizens and the judges who were to help them. Sometimes I wonder whether we've moved a bit away from that, because really the courts are there to get their barristers and solicitors and for them to get paid. But nonetheless, they have a role. So, the courts, and we talk about access to justice, but we get to a stage where we say, well, you people have been litigating for a long time now. We've got to draw a line under this, and it's got to stop. So people who come back repeatedly, and they lose repeatedly, and the courts say, well, there's no justice in this, there's no merit in this, we're now going to stop you. And they declare them vexatious. And that means they can't issue any more new legal proceedings without the court giving them the okay. So the court then takes control of their litigation. They've only been used 15 times in Victoria, in 75 years. And the reason that we have it is because of this man here, Rupert Mullane. And he's one of my favourites, he's one of the 15. And a real pioneer in the 1920s, he saw the coming of the bus. The bus came to Melbourne in the 1920s, and it did two things. It had steel wheels, and it destroyed the roads. And so people like Jane on the council didn't like that very much, because the council were responsible for fixing the roads, and it cost them a fortune. And the other thing it did is people liked the buses, because the buses could come to the curb, and you could get on them, and you didn't have to get your feet wet in the mud and all the rest. Then they would actually ride at home sometimes. And so that's the other thing it did, was to impact the revenues of the train system. And the state government has spent a fortune on the train system, and we had a very good train system. Now, of course, people are now saying it's not good enough, but in the 1920s it was very good. And so the revenues of the train were But of course the bus was very popular, so everybody started running bus lines, and this was the invention of the bus. And you tend to assume that the boys had buses, but they had to start sometime. Bus stops had to be invented, bus routes had to be invented, pedestrian crossings had to be invented, all those things happened. So Rupert Mullane was right in there, and he was a great successor. But the government had known that they can't have a bit of order, we're going to regulate. So they passed the first bus act. And that had the effect of introducing a seat tax, which said that if you wanted to be a bus operator, you're going to pay a tax per seat. And of course, that was wiped out. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why is Grenville's bus, they just had their 75%, they paid the tax. But Mullane Hipperson, he's just saying he's become student of the law. He said he's going to be fascinated with it. But he goes to the State Library, Supreme Court Library, and he discovered that in Victoria, imperial law still applies, because we took our laws from Britain. and say we took, theoretically, we took all the English laws. And in 1926 they had a review here that they were also these laws really should apply, which suddenly they decided to get rid of quite a few of them, but they didn't get rid of all of them. And he discovered that the Carriage Act of, I think, about 1726 applied in Victoria. Of course, that was designed for horse and cart, and that was designed to give special rights to horse and cart or stagecoaches to go through London to other places as a minimum tax. So he discovered that you could get a carriage licence in Victoria under this old English Act for 2 and 6 foot by going to the JP, which is much cheaper than getting a bus licence. He went to the JP and said, I'd like a carriage act license for 2 and 6, and the JP said, oh, okay. And of course, that really got the government on the skin. And so every time they tried to prosecute, they changed the act to put up the fines for not having a bus licence. But every time they did, he'd sue them back. And he sued the Minister for Roads, the Minister for Transport, and went backwards and forwards. Every time they pulled him up and prosecuted him, he prosecuted the Bylaws Office for doing that as well. So a whole lot of litigation. So that was going on. Now, while that was going on, he was also... Oops. He was... So he took them to court, and the headline here in the Argus is Mullane drives the stagecoach through the bus law, because then he was challenged by the government. They said, oh, okay, you can have a carriage out bus. So all the other bus proprietors said, oh, all right, this is the way to go, you're going to have to pay the tax. And of course they had to change the law against the fine like that, but he kept suing them. Now, while he was doing that, he was building a kerosene tin house in Heidelberg, in Lower Heidelberg Road. Because there'd been a bushfire and 20, 30 people had been killed, and he thought, and there'd also been a, because this was when the car was coming and petrol was coming and all the byproducts of petrol were coming, and he'd been selling kerosene out in the back lots of the soldier settlements of the valley, and there's been all these kerosene tins lying around. So he said, I reckon the solution to the shortage of building materials to have a fireproof house is to build a house of empty kerosene tins. Now, I'm sure Jane and I would be very pleased to see houses being built all around Elwood and Brighton. And so the Heidelberg Shire, Heidelberg, they were not best pleased either. And there is some suggestion that this character, and there's, I've only been able to find one photo of it in the 1st of May of about 1926, all the wonderful couple of walls are up there. He tried to patent it, he sued them for not giving him a patent. In the end, the Shire of Heidelberg, they made a serious mistake. They ordered it to be demolished, and it was demolished. And of course, what did he do? He sued them. Sued them backwards and forwards for stealing works of art, theft of property. He even convened a grand jury. He discovered this concept of a grand jury, and he took them down to the site, and they awarded him £1,000 damages, etc. There's no legal authority for it, but nonetheless, he did it because he was doing it all himself. So, all in all, he had about 200 pieces of litigation going in the Supreme Court, because that was mainly where the action was, but I did quite a bit in the Magistrates Court in a short period. So they said, enough's enough. And so they passed the law to give them the power to knock people out. Because traditionally, they say, well, people should have their day in court. We shouldn't be just only when you can't come to court. So they said, the courts weren't prepared to just take that on themselves. They said, we need a special law to do that. So what they did, they borrowed one from England, because England had had a similar challenge in 1896 with a guy called Chappie, who'd been suing the Speaker of the House of Commons and the British Library and the Duke of that. And so they passed the law. So what Victoria did was just take that law. Now, it's interesting that legislators, when they do this, is they don't do it in a transparent way, because what they did is they had a consolidation of the law at the same time, they just slid this English law into our Supreme Court Act. So it didn't go through the normal process of a bill being introduced to Parliament, having a second reading speech and then getting signed off by the Governor. Because it was already a law in England, they moved it into the consolidation of the Supreme Court Act, that was it. Which means that everybody that ever after who's tried to find out how this law was enacted has been able to find it. It's just not in the debate. So they think conspiracy, this is not a real law at all. And it's because they just simply adopted one from England and just used the same words. So that's why it's there, Reverend Mullane. I think he's the prince of For instance, let's say there's a tea, he lived around here for a while, he's in Brighton. He took the Brighton Council on for quite some time. And one of the themes that runs through their festivities is local government. Now, there's a lot of it, and it's not surprising really, because most of our interactions with government are at the local government level, whether it's at a party or rubbish or things left in the laneway or noise of the neighbours and that. And it always surprises me really that at local government level we really don't have dispute resolution techniques that we have for banks and insurance companies and what have you. Now, we don't have any ombudsman who gets to deal with them. So that's all by way of background. I'm trying now to the next one. Let me go to Sir Alfred Davis. Now, Alfred Davis was a woman born in Carlton, but they came to live in St Kilda. So we said they lived in Bale Street for quite some time. Then she did move later on to Hartley Street in Holland, which is just down the corner here from the shops and all. She was born as a Jewish family in 1907, and I had to look that date up as her birthday because her age got lower and lower as she got older and older. That's one of the things in her story. But she was an outstanding child prodigy on the videos. She could play the xylophone. She was just fantastic. She played piano, she learned classically at the Royal Conservatory here in Melbourne. Her sister, Olga, for those of you who could also play, and the baby Olga, as she's called, only died about a year or so ago in the late 90s. I did have the privilege of just meeting her at a coffee just over here in Melbourne, just before she died. But Elsa in particular, she too, in the days of the silent movement, she used to be the person who played piano, and particularly at interval. Which most people will remember the interval in the cinema. She used to do the circuit. She did the circuit all around Australia at Her Majesty's Theatre, and she's only a teenager when she's doing it. So she was outstanding. And what killed her career at that stage was the Talkies. The Talkies came about 1927, and that just killed her career. So she by that stage, she's about 21, but she starts to compose and do other things. Going the wrong way at the time. She did, one of the things she did do was do a tour to Europe.
I think
we'll be
okay.
You'll be okay? Okay. Unless you want to go to the next room, you want to take a seat? No, okay, keep on. Thanks for that. So she did, her mother's marriage broke down in about 1930, so they went on a tour, on a cruise. And this one here is a flyer for a concert she did in Egypt for the army and what have you there, when they went through the Suez Canal. Sister and her mother met the Dragon Tour in 11 there in Lourdes, and they got all the sicknesses and that. So again, her mother was English, so you often when they were back to the age, if they went back to Suez Canal and then they came back. But she used this opportunity to be a tour of the world. And later on in her own story, she's done the world tour of Paris and all that other stuff. But the only thing I can find really is that she went to Egypt and she got off the boat there. Now, the first legal proceedings took place here in St Kilda Magistrates Court, which used to be where the police station was, I think, when they pulled it down many years ago. And so we came back to Melbourne, and a number of things started to pop up here in her life. She had a flat in Barclay Street. And the owner of the flat was a guy who used to do talks down at the Yarra Bank and had been attended to Melbourne, an elderly guy, and this is a theme that runs through her life, her special friendships with older gentlemen. And it fell into dispute at some stage because he then sued her for non-payment of rent. And one of the catalysts for that was apparently when he came into the flat one day and he saw her fiancé, a German gentleman, in the flat. And he didn't take kindly to that, about 1930s. So he sued her in the old court for rent. She countersued for him not paying for his piano lessons that she'd been giving him. And of course, it got fabulous coverage in the Truth. And I think most of the people would remember the Truth. And then what a loss of journalism it is, the Truth is going on. The court in particular was so the headline here is, composer Edna Davis may may miss a new note. It was the Yarra Bank lecturer who called the tune. And what I like about the tune is they were very clever in their writing and very accurate, so they have to be careful they weren't getting food, but it's very, very good record of it. And there's a photograph of her in the hat, and then the choice of photographs in the tune have always made magnificent sense. They've got the elderly Yarra Bank lecturer there looking at a real lech, in the corner. So that was her first one. She lost that one. But what's interesting about that was that it showed that she seemed to be repetitive in the way that she cross-examined. You know, she wasn't bound by the rules of evidence, so she could be the most ferocious cross-examination regarding that she would get away with it. It frustrated the magistrate unbelievably. And also the things like the old gentleman involved, etc. And there's a nice little picture of the old people of the court there, which I quite like. Anyway, she's in her early 20s now, lost her career on the music circuit because of the talkies. She decides to get married. And my take on this is that her mother had been married after the first marriage collapsed, and had married an older man. And he had then died and left her 2 houses in Bailsley. I think the seed of an opportunity may have been part of her mind there, because very quickly she had a very quick romance with John Isaacs. John Isaacs, I think people would say, was a confirmed bachelor at that stage. She was 75 and never been married. He'd been a member of the State Parliament, and of course his older brother is Sir Isaac Martin, who'd been the Governor General and written the Constitution, and had also been the Chief Justice of the High Court. Not an unknown character at the time. So she marries John Isaacs, and that's a nice little photo of them that pops up. Sir Isaac on there, and John Isaacs there, and a French wedding gown, etc. And the photo, of course, was taken by Axel Smith, and surely the photographer in the main, obviously rings a bell, and he pops up. So one of the things in all of these stories is the names and the links and the networks that pop up of Melbourne's just very close. So the marriage didn't travel well, you'd be surprised to hear. And she went through the money very quickly. And I don't wish to be unfair to her, but the family talk about the Rolls Royce getting out to take them to a house in Auburn, where John Isaacs had a family home. And a lot of the dispute centred on the family home, which is still there. It's at 1 Goodall Street, Auburn. Now, this had been a house that Sir Isaac had bought for his parents back in the 1800s, but it's along the way it had been transferred into John Isaac's name, so this was his house. Now, Edna Day herself, or Mrs. Isaacs, I should say, was told that the house would be hers in due course. She discovered that Isaac had told his brother, "I think you should move the house out of your name into my name." And the moment he discovered that, the marriage was over. At this stage, the fact that marriage was over, it's been a very hectic 6 months. John Isaac really starts to decline after that. He's sort of dropped out of the picture. But Sir Isaac Isaacs was in his 80s, and history will tell us that Isaac Isaacs was really not a very likeable man. He had an outstanding intellect, and was a great contributor to public life, but on a personal level he didn't really have many friends, and he was a bit of a puff operator. And of course he was born in about 1856, so he had a different set of moral values that perhaps may have been a bit different to those of the 1930s. So he took upon himself to make sure that this woman got nothing, and that was his name. And so John Isaacs moved out of his big house, and Isaac had the water turned off, had the electricity turned off, had the gas turned off, took the maid out, took the car away. And so what's the girl to do? So she took the diamond ring to raise a bit of money. There's no single parent's benefit in this day. So she took, I'm not that she was a mother, but she took her wedding ring and pawned it with one of the pawn brothers involved. That was a big mistake, because this wedding ring had been a decorated house by this mother. And it's well documented that Isaac had a mother fixation. He thought more of his mother than he thought of his own family.
and people who first were doing 70s and all the rest of it. In the 40s was always this sort of unsatisfactory. So he went down to the form broker and put IMC Open Markets plus 90, which is a pretty cheap form broker action, and they were pretty good to see that. And of course, what's the girl to do? She sues the pawnbroker. Well, she sues the salesman, and she sues everybody inside on that in the Supreme Court. And of course, what does the court think about that? That there's, no, that's not the thing. Criticise the thing, you have a case of cost against Japan. So she appeals that one, but really, but she's doing it herself. She's getting cross examined to Isaac in the court, etc. Gets quite a lot of publicity because we're now getting into the about 1940s, a lot of publicity, again because of truth. So the next one she does is, well, the other thing that happened was Ridgway, the removalists, you may have heard of, so Isaac sent them in to get the furniture into the house, and but he was very fair, according to himself, because one of, and this is a lesson to us all here, one of the things he used to do to Isaac was write to his daughters, two daughters, every week, send them a letter. And I always had a joke, so I could do a nice little book on Sir Isaac's jokes over a few years. And one daughter threw them out, obviously, but another daughter kept them. Because Sir Isaac, before he died, destroyed all of his papers, because he said, my judgments in the High Court will be what I'm remembered for. And let me tell you, no one looked at the Michael Harvard's judgment in the High Court, because the High Court moved on. But the letters are in the National Library. You say you have a great deal of time reading the letters. And of course, they traverse quite a lot of Australian history. They're very interesting letters. But in those letters, he says, and I have told Mr. Ridgway that he's not to take anything out of the room with the excise. And that was the event. But everything else is to go. So this is the indication of his stance. So what she did is she sued his place. And of course, what did the judge decide in that? No, clearly there's Sir Isaac's furniture, he's allowed to have it. Because there's no family law act at this stage, and it's all, whoever's name of the game, it's all Sir Isaac's. So that goes on appeal a couple of times as well, and she loses all of those cases, and it all gets very salacious, and people get cross-examined. Now, the next one was, finish with Ridgway. In fact, I tried to ask Ridgway because there's some resistance because I have any records, but they don't want to know about this. And they learned their lesson because one of the things they did, people, when they've been attacked in court, they want to get even, and so they go after the costs. And when you're dealing with a vexatious litigant, that's a serious mistake because the bankruptcy court is a different jurisdiction, takes you from the state jurisdiction to the Commonwealth jurisdiction. And also it means that you've got to start the whole thing again. Because they call you in if you're going to do the fair bankrupt, they make a split share and they ask you. That's your whole life. And so it's an opportunity to tell the whole story again. And the beauty for researchers is that all these things are typed up. And so they're all in the National Archives. So they get the whole story, so it's really great for researchers. But it's another opportunity to litigate the whole thing. So after 8 court cases, she was declared a vexatious litigant in Victoria, which is at a very low end of the registrar. Because Britain's alone, they talk about, was 200. She had 8. It was more time. One of the people involved is Sir Isaac Calvert, and of course, we can't have him being in that. And the important thing about the vexatious litigant application is it has to be initiated by the Attorney General. None of us in this room can actually start over that person with the person. So the Attorney General has to make the application to the Supreme Court. So it means it's always going to be a political decision. And if you happen to be a former Chief Justice, probably you would accelerate up the path if you get this application out. Now, that was the end of it. Sir Isaac wanted to declare a bankruptcy. He was going to get him costs. And that went on and on and on for quite a long time. The other thing that happened is that John Isaac died. And the will was, the executor of the will was Sir Isaac. There was absolutely nothing in the estate because the house was in Sir Isaac's name by the estate. The only thing in the estate was a safe, ironically, worth about £10. The whole estate was worth £15, I think, and the safe, why did he keep the safe and declare it was beyond me, but they did. Anyway, a fight went on for 6 years as to who should be, in a sense, the executor. of the will. There's nothing to fight on, but the fight and mind for so long. And so Isaac Wolf is determined to make sure she's got not even her name in it.
So the fight was sort of between them. They made it bankrupt. Going the wrong way. John Isaacs said yes, but he was not involved in this really. It was all for Isaac Isaacs, yeah. Now, she's becoming quite knowledgeable about the legal system. It's quite a strong position for the lawyer helping her in that case, because the language is to people to figure up off the street. But she becomes expert on the efficient and I've got to make a bankrupt the second time. We already knew that Brendan Fussler had made a bankrupt and led him enough because they could realise on that the bankrupt we want to see this. And that's a very sensible decision for a legacy to make this sometimes, just to keep it cold. I don't feel provoking it. So she discovered that some of the key players in this were friends. So what we have here is Judge Klein, who had been the judge in the Ring case, and heavily involved in that, had been a judge in another case, he then got promoted to the bankruptcy court. So guess who the judge was in the bankruptcy court? He kept coming here in the same case all the time. Judge Klein. Over here is Mr. Mulvaney, who later became a county court judge, but he was the Isaac's counsel in all of these cases. So here they all are at 9 Darling Street, having a lovely little powwow, of course, published in the Packer or one of the magazines, I think. And so Isaac, Alpha Davis discovered this, and so part of her appeal to the High Court against the second bankruptcy, which is Isaac's bankruptcy, was the fact, well, I don't think justice has been done here. All these people have been sat behind the scenes, you know, this is not a good look here. And we'll never know how the High Court will have decided that because the Isaac Isaac that not to the court came up. And that was the end of this litigation. Just stopped. Now, she wasn't interested anymore. And she didn't even bother to get discharged from the bankruptcy until the 1960s because it was really all about him, part of the long time. So that was what made her get such a living. So that was about 1943. So life goes on. New beginnings, she remarries. Now I think this is just outside Sacred Heart Church down in Christchurch, right? And I think this may well be the wedding that was used in the Isaac marriage. This is about 1954. And this time she married the younger man. He's about 25, 26 years younger than her. And from all reports, you know, there was an affection there. A cynic might say that this was one way to get an income, because we're in the 50s now. But this country is composed and doing things like that, doing entertaining around. And he was a Romanian who had come out after the war looking for jobs and from behind the iron dropping out of the Iron Curtain. Had limited English, but there was meant to be affection there. One of the things she became very good at was composing songs, and she composed a ditty for everyone. And one of the things she did in late 1950s was compose a song to the dog in the bucket, and sent it off to Christchurch. Now you've got to remember that that the Petros has just been expelled, ASIO has just been set up. The Cold War is running rampant. And here we have a local St Kilda lady writing to Christian, composing, celebrating the Russians being first in space. And if you were Christian, what would you do? Here's an opportunity to get back at one of the Australian governments. So he wrote back and he said he's going to have to publish some plays by the Kremlin band and all the rest of it. And this is typical of what she did really for the rest of her life. Any big event in the world, she would write, compose a song and send it off. And she'd get the courtesy of the fly back from the lady in waiting with the Queen and Queen Mother and President Kennedy and whoever it was. and this convinced her that she was good mates with all of these people around the world. And she used to kind of take these letters in a bag and we'd show them to you, even if it was art. And if she wrote to you, probably would get copies of these letters passive. Which again is great for research because you're able to find for the people. One of the interesting things I found was she wrote to Harold Holtz, and he was the treasurer, about a song that she composed, and when you go to the National Archives on the database, up comes their name and they have a file for Harold Holt. And attached to it is a letter that that Isaacs had written to his brother saying, how are we going to get out of the house more or less? And otherwise you wouldn't have access to that letter. And it sort of showed that Sir Isaac Isaacs was not really being a very nice person. In amongst him saying that letter, that he just co-hosted a dinner at Sydney at Government House with the Governor of New South Wales, and Bob Menzies walked in and they had a chat and all the rest of it. So you get a bit of insight into what's happening behind the scenes. So anyway, the composer song. This, of course, did take the interest of ASIO, and it struck me when I was doing this research, I wonder if ASIO have a file. And you can apply for the file. So they'll tell you whether they got them or not. And if they got them, they're going to get access, they'll tell you. And they said, yes, you can have it. And for 10 years, ASIO followed them around. And the most banal stuff, you wouldn't believe what they did. They'd been in the house there, half fish street, to have a look and inspect it without going there. They investigated the lawyer who was acting for her in one other matter. They looked for the books they were buying from the Carlton International Bookshop. And when you look at the list of who was also buying books, Rob Jolly pops up. And he was the treasurer of Victoria, but obviously he was a young academic at the time. You know? And it's a fascinating insight to what goes on behind the scenes you never know about. So anyway, this is in the 60s. So the next thing, and that's a letter from Buckingham Palace saying what a wonderful lobby you've just sent me about Prince William. So the next thing that happens is that they're living in Nail Street because her mother had died and left one of the houses to the sister and given one of the houses to Elsa. And all of a sudden, the gas hot water heater went bang. So they say. And so this led to litigation. The gas and fuel company got sued because the shock of it. And so the plaintiff was the husband, the second husband. But you probably can guess who was driving the fucking And the Supreme Court writ went on to about 27 pages, 10 pages. And this really got on that one, you know, the last few pages, the most quickly in this claim. And so the gas and fuel and letters, all the people who were all in the claim, all the suit, they still could strike it out. And so they sent it, and you can do that in chamber applications for the Supreme Court, just and you go before a master and ask for the matters to be struck out and whatever. So they briefed a guy called Dick McGarvey, who'd just taken silk, had just become a QC, and you know, people get a little bit sort of special when they become QC, and said, what do I get across the chamber before? You know, this is a specific season for me. And apparently came back exhausted. It took 2.5 hours. And I guess completely paragraph. Obviously, if there's not a woman, you could sort of like rush over. So, and eventually the case went to court and it struck out, and he sued again and again and again. So he became an exchange student. So they're the first, and as far as I can see, the only husband and wife seen in Australia to be declared vexatious. But of course, they, in that case, they said, who's really writing these documents? And, you know, because she had a different name, of course, she was Mrs. Black Boffy then. Yeah. And so they threw the dots together. And what you find is the lawyers involved in these cases all have formed themselves. They're all the same lawyers. And so a number of the people who were sued in that case are Norman Banks, you might recall on the radio, because he obviously said something on the radio, he got sued. So all good fun, really, from a distance. So local government, this is one of you, Jane. Local government, a cradle for disputes. Now, I might have a little bit of a video if I can get it to go here. One of the things he's doing at this stage is he's performing on the Mike Walsh show and on all of those midday shows that he used to be on. They're fascinating because they were in the 60s and 70s at the time when there was a lot of time and they're indulgent in the way they did. So she used to go by bus and play the piano and do a routine on the TV. And she did this in a lot of the TV shows at that stage with Dirk Newton and the Graham Simpson, not in the same thing, John Lane. So there's quite a lot of footage that they're doing. So hopefully this thing has features and we might be able to actually
I'd like you to make welcome to the Mike Wells Show a very remarkable lady, Miss Elsa Davis. You wrote the headlines in Melbourne recently. We've got some newspaper cuttings here.
Yes.
Just explain to people what went wrong. It was about your dog, wasn't it?
Well, the councilman came along and he said that it barked. Well, I said, well, all dogs bark, and he doesn't bark in the night time because I'm a bad sleeper. I wouldn't have a dog bark. And I have three dogs. I've had dogs all my life. And, however, then after that he went away, and I said, why don't you chase the bank robbers and leave the dogs alone? That was a good thing for him. And the rapists.
Reinventing herself because of the baby boomers, you know, getting to 18, 19 and going to Parkinson. Here the rest of us are having a big thing in Melbourne, and she's now a grandmotherly figure who's very good on the piano and can play, and she was a natural for this type of thing. And but you can see, very indulgent in time on the television.
Yeah.
The red thing she was wearing, I think, was Lady Isaacs. It was a Paris, you remember, because it's mentioned in the country and many other things. But she did get a few things in that marriage. But you can see the determination.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The system is not perfect, a little system. And how you control some people is all of the
challenge. She's very
dangerous too. Yeah, she is. But I mean, if you're in a cross case against something like that, it can be pretty tough. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But that's right. Yeah. In this environment, absolutely. So,
Well, I mean, she
tripped
everything around
her
in such a way that she
kept
really confused about where it was coming from.
That's right. Well, that's why people go, that's why you have barristers, and that's because they keep it stuck. That's why judges like cases to be advocated by barristers, because they all people speak Latin and they know what's going on. But these people are all over the place. So anyway, she did go on appeal, and she borrowed it down from Corporate Productions. Have a briefcase. Cross-examined the bylaws officer, who apparently in an earlier life had some trouble with prison, and had gone to prison for, shall we say, sex offences, and she discovered that. So she was cross-examining on that episode. Nothing to do with the case at all. But anyway, the judge, the late Justice McNabb, apparently had a hoot of time in the County Court Appeal and so he reduced the fine from $10 to $5. The front page of the Herald. That was 56 here. This is, I think it's about 6 or about 20 years in the IPA, so according on the face of that. So here we are, composer, entertainer, a cult figure. Now, I've got a series of these clips now, which give you a sense of the performance style. She was everywhere. There used to be over here in the old shops there, there used to be a line out and there was a cafe she used and she used to play there and play. She around the second half of the weekend. She'd go to the pubs along Beacon Street Road and play there, zoom around the world and play. And she made a bit of money that way, but I think also she was drawing attention at the same time. So where the money comes from, never really been quite clear.
This is a Wimbledon tennis ball,
Doug.
Yeah, you have seen my dog captain, how he runs to catch the ball.
I think had she not been distracted by Sir Arthur Lawrence for 10 years in this litigation, she could have gone international, she could have easily been an international star, because she clearly had the ability. So, now I think there's another one. This is another one. This is a power up song. You can't get over power. But this year actually is the 150th anniversary of the Melbourne Cup, and a friend of mine has been writing a book about that. Where is Farlap's Cup? Is one of his things, because Farlap's Cup is gone, missing. So he's writing a book about that. So expect to see a lot more about the Melbourne Cup as we get towards November. But can you imagine all that stuff being on television today? And there's red faces on that, as about as close as you get to it. Yeah, I think I have one more. She was a genuine composer, and one of the songs that she used to do this song, one of the ones she wrote did was the Centennial March for the Centennial of Melbourne in 1934. And it was meant that this year should have been the 100th, last year should have been the 150th anniversary of Melbourne. But for some strange reason, in the election year, the government had decreed that this year will be Victoria's 150th anniversary. So that's taking place. Oh, my great song. It's 150, 175, whatever. So, and so she wrote a song called Centennial March, which was played to the opening of the shrine in 1934. Mm-hmm. The governor of Duke of Gloucester, when he came to open the shrine, heard it as he came off the bay in the boat, just before Tullamarine. He heard it at the opening of the shrine. He heard it at Government House. He heard it at Cuckoo. And I don't think it was ever played again until we played it at the launch of my book. So I found the music in the National Archives. And but she used to send them off to everybody. And in fact, she's never offered Duke of Gloucester, and he went on to become the Governor General. You know, and I don't think he'd actually made the connection between her and Isaac Isaacs. Now, this is another one. This is at the last one. This is one of the compositions being played at the opening of the West Cape Bridge, which was about 30 years old last year. She did the mighty West Cape Bridge, which I think is a fabulous little song. Now, so you've got a bit of a feel for her as an entertainer and a cult figure and what people think of her. So when we go, she gets reviewed in the papers by the media or the light arts people. And Peter Weiniger, who you may have read, he used to write the cabaret items in the Age. And about the musical things happening around the world. He wrote in 1980, sharing the bill in what is one of the most adventurous shows staged, The Flying Trapeze, since the heyday of radical cabaret, is Asia's eccentric Elsa Davis. Surely one of our most enduring institutions, Davis, with her duties honouring the royal family and the Liberal Party, has been acknowledged for her excellence from Buckingham Palace to Spring Street. Seated at the piano, dressed in dancing sequins, she enthralls her audience with renditions of Waltzing Matilda as Beethoven and Mendelssohn would have composed our national song. Then he said, 3 years later, he said, rounding off the evening is indestructible Elsa Davis, composer of such epics as the Ode to Father, which we just heard. Miss Davis once played honky-tonk piano accompanied by a singing dog. Here she performs solo, and it is a tribute to her artistry that the absence of a canine is hardly noticeable. Now, I think you were a bit upset about that. I am.
She's who?
Now, so, let me see. So, of course, she's a vexatious litigant. So, in order to get permission to sue, you've got to go back in and ask the judge to say, I believe I've been defamed. They said I'm an eccentric, and I've looked up my thesaurus, and eccentric says Rasputin and Nasty and the rest of my other things. I believe I should be able to sue the army for defamation and for the warrant. And you can see, I've been Justice Pocket. You can almost see the government. You've got a woman who's grandmotherly type, not going to harm anybody. The army's got deep pockets. We're a bit too much serious in our life, let's have a bit of fun here. So he gave her leave. And it takes a while to get on to court, and I interviewed the now QC who appeared to have expected a journal up to me, regarded as one of the best technology comparisons in Australia now. This was the case that's getting in his way. He probably became a fabulous day in court. And he said to his solicitor, a chap called, he was Tony Smith, who late Tony Smith, these litigants never settle. You won't be able to give her any money for this. She will want to go on the state. Let's get ready for court. And Tony Smith should have known that because he was involved himself in a case involving the RSPCA, which was another big vexatious litigant in the 60s. So anyway, he did go to hearing about 2 years later. And she turned up, she had a photograph of Sir Isaac Isaacs on the bar table. She had lovely outfits on, and case ran. And she, an important part of the Asia's case is they had to sort of say she was eccentric, and so they went to get the videotape of the scene, the Channel 9 with the dog. And it's a Channel 9 dog, apparently. It used to go, and so they got the Mike Walsh Show, the 2000 edition about it, which was on and off. And the little thing that interests me, because they had to show it. And I said to the judge, oh, you want to come, we actually show this footage. And the judge said, oh, yes, where would you like the camera, and where would you like the screen, the projector? And this is just on the coming of the videos, the big videos, and so it was on the TV. And the judge had never seen one of these things before. And so she came around to see the new technology. You know, everyone would like to see how this new TV screen. So they showed the female clip of her playing the piano, and the dog goes, because she denied that she was in front of the dog, and they were trying to attack her credibility here. And of course, apparently the court did this very quickly. They had to leave the court for it was packed. And of course, the jury spent 9 minutes. Deciding that the age had not defamed her, but she thought that was a pretty good result. But she lost against the age, because the age stole papers on this. Just the thing, we didn't have the truth. She got appeal on that case as well. But then she passed away. And this is another poignant one, I think, now in view of the recent bushfire, the climate.
One of Melbourne's most unusual entertainers, Elsa Parlap Davis, was buried today. The dear old musician died last Friday of cancer. In a simple ceremony, Elsa was farewelled by her husband of 36 years, the two sisters, and close friends. Her colourful career began at the age of 4. She played anything on the piano and was a prolific songwriter. Her three greatest loves were people, animals, and music. Last public appearance was at the Victorian Supreme Court, where she unsuccessfully sued the age for calling her an eccentric. The day that performance was described as the best of her life.
Mm-hmm. So that really is the issue. That's a Chinese outfit, because at the stage she was playing in the Chinese restaurants in Little Bird Street, and she would shamelessly promote them on national television. And in one of her songs, she had a restaurant. The third thing is now, she'd be speaking a few Chinese words, then she'd go,
meow, meow.
She just couldn't do it. So, anyway, that's the story of Elsa Davis. The Governor General, was a big part of her life, it was really under 10 years, really. Sir Isaac doesn't come out of it very well at all. He, in many respects, was the best place to live, because he kept it going and he was really getting excited about it. He used his resources and his ability to keep it going. These days, it would be different, it wouldn't be able to do it. She was a cult figure. She was very much a local identity. Mm-hmm. Dale Street, down near the house, she tried to get his payments and rezone it to light industrial so she could make some money out of development.
Yes.
And he refused, he was a minister for planning, and he wouldn't do it. But shortly thereafter, they did do it. Mm-hmm. So now on the spot is a petrol station and a little factory etching there. So she truly one of the local identities, and the house in Huff District still there. I'm tempted to go and knock on the door and say, if you don't know that Adrian is in this house. So anyway, I'm happy to get in for the Christmas. Sorry to get you here so long. It's a good story. Okay.
I think it also shows that the system's not perfect.
And the system sometimes comes out of it very badly. Yeah. And all of the vexatious litigant cases, I do six of them in this book. Not only are they good stories, but they also show that the system doesn't behave well. And the lawyers in particular don't behave well. And so you do need the checks and balances, etc. So it's really only history that you can stand back and, because if you're in the middle of it, it's a bit hard to make that judgment. Only when you get through it, when you're attacked, because that was a couple of problems.
and he doesn't want the children.
Any more questions?
Governor General Sir Isaac Isaac, mm-hmm. When was he the Governor General? He was our first Australian-born Governor General, and it's 1930 to 1935. The King got in turn, the King wouldn't have got the credit they'd always been in.